From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. On this anniversary of 9/11, the American public and the media are once again focused on terrorism. President Obama gave his speech to the country last night, announcing airstrikes against the group ISIS. Obama addressed a nation horrified by videos showing Islamic militants killing two American journalists, both of whom, by the way, had strong New Hampshire ties, James Foley from Rochester and Stephen Sutloff, who attended private school in Meriden. Our guest today is a longtime journalist who finds herself now immersed in questions about how her profession has covered these deeply disturbing stories. There's the debate over a self-imposed news blackout of journalist kidnappings, arguments over use of the videos and photographs of these men's deaths, and whether by disseminating these terrifying images, reporters are actually helping the militants accomplish their goals. We're talking this hour with Brooke Gladstone, co-host of the NPR program On the Media. Gladstone's in New Hampshire this week. She spoke at UNH last night and joins us now. And let's hear from you throughout the hour. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Brooke, welcome back to New Hampshire. It's been a while. It's nice to see you.
I know. It's great to be here.
Well, I want to take just a couple minutes, Brooke, and just acknowledge that it's 9/11, obviously a very sober day. You were in New York at the time, the relatively newly minted co-host of On the Media. You guys started, relaunched the show in January. And so in that role, you had to look at how these attacks were covered. And boy, there's a lot we've learned. What are some of the big pullouts from that for journalists, Brooke?
Yeah, that was, I'll start with the really personal and then I'll broaden out to the cosmic and galactic. But basically, the station, WNYC, which produces the show, which is distributed by NPR, was really only a few blocks from the World Trade Center. And we were evacuated right after. On that day, I was at the doctor's office across the bridge in Brooklyn. I tried to get in across the bridges. I kept getting repelled by the cops. And so I watched, trying to slip by the cops, the people coming off the bridges covered in dust. It was one of those kind of poignantly, ironically, bizarrely, spectacularly beautiful September days.
Sounds like being
days.
In a movie, you know? And
they all walked off the bridge covered in dust, like statues, like moon characters. And then the merchants by the side of the bridge just handed bottles of water to them. And, you know, there were people, you know, carrying their high-heeled shoes or just, you know, limping or just walking in pristine business suits except for the layer of dust. It was cinematic and it was horrible. And personally, a big problem was that I couldn't report on it, which is how I process information. I went on with Scott Simon and I did a live call-in at Columbia. It wasn't until we got settled at Channel 13, a public television, for a few weeks that we could get the show back up. Okay, so enough about me.
So you couldn't do your own show.
Couldn't do my own.
Sure.
Couldn't do my own show. And
while your city was crumbling.
As you know, you get into this job and people think, well, why do you do it? And there's a whole variety of reasons why. But for me, I can't really cope with something. I can't process it unless I'm trying to explain it to somebody else. I don't seem to have the rigor to sit there and do it for myself. But for other people, I'll work as hard as I can. Anyway, so we were back, and the first thing we did was talk about the first 24 hours, that arc of coverage. And we saw, basically, coverage that was not that great, especially in the first couple of hours. You know, there were attacks that were erroneous about the World Trade Center and other not about the White House and other locations, other planes. Of course, initially, it was reported as just some private plane that had gone off course. I mean, that is the trouble with needing explanations right away. They're invariably wrong. As we have found out and done the same kind of dissection of all kinds of disasters since, from Katrina to the Sandy Hook massacre. The first rounds of press coverage are always wrong, and that is our longing for information and the great gaping news holes of mostly the 24-hour cable channels, where most of that information goes wrong. And of course, the retweets of wrong information that each and every one of us as a citizen of this media ecosphere often contribute to, but hold ourselves blameless for. So we need to take responsibility for that.
Well, and that's the other thing that's interesting is that 9/11, you didn't have people tweeting news or posting news items on their Facebook pages. So now I'm guessing that that first brush of history, as they call journalism, you know, the first draft of history, that breaking news, is it more accurate now, given that you have more voices, or is it less accurate now, given that you have more voices?
It is certainly not more accurate. It is, like everything else, now a function of abundance rather than scarcity, abundance of information. So everything that we had before, the best accuracy and the worst inaccuracy, not to mention the plain maliciousness of certain people or mischievousness of certain people, to throw other things into the eco-biosphere of media, it creates a greater opportunity for confusion, but with a careful sifting, a greater and quicker opportunity to learn what is really happening piecemeal. You still need somebody or some organization to put together a truthful narrative of events. But of course, with our cell phones, we can be there and we can see a slice. I mean, they used to say, another consequence of 9/11, that the coverage of the war in Iraq was seen by reporters through a soda straw because they were embedded with troops, an absolute innovation that the Pentagon created in order to cover that war. And what you've got now in every situation on the ground everywhere is a proliferation, a confluence of soda straws. And that's when things are going well.
I want to ask you about Iraq for sure, because it's often said, Brooke, that the media fell down on that story. But one more issue on this topic of breaking news. You guys at On the Media have kind of created a primer for folks now. I mean, we have seen, unfortunately, other terrible instant tragedies, and you have been trying to help people out with that. Here's what you need to know about breaking news coverage. Give us just a little bit of that, Brooke, please.
Well, I think we went a little large on the title. We should probably have called it Breaking, the News Consumer's Guide to Breaking News After a Mass Shooting, because that is when we saw the consistent pattern of inaccuracy occur. And we were able to just sort of delineate what it was. So when there is a mass shooting, and we did this after the Washington Navy Yard shooting, long after Sandy Hook, and before dozens of college shootings and other shootings that have happened since, there are some things that are always reported wrong in the first few rounds of coverage. And one is the name of the perpetrator, frequently the name and number of the victims. And here's one that so far has been wrong every single time. I'm not going to say it will always and forever be wrong, but let me just say this to the public out there. According to our research, not yet proven wrong, there is never a second shooter. It is always reported in the first rounds somewhere that there is a second shooter, or they're looking for a second shooter. There isn't one.
Maybe there's always a fear that it could be worse.
I'm sure. And maybe the sense that, I don't know, maybe this goes back to the Kennedy assassination. Who can say? But this is our News Consumer's Guide. We had it. I did a story on it. We printed a kind of a printout that you could put next to your computer or your telephone or your television just to remind you. And the general message is one to just those of you out there who are news junkies, who need to know things right away, you are going to have to wait.
It's not something we like to do. these days. The phone number here in the exchange, you won't have to wait to talk to Brooke Gladstone, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Brooke Gladstone is in New Hampshire this week. She joins us. She's the co-host of the award-winning NPR program On the Media. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So here we are, Brooke, on 9/11 with the president last night saying he's going after another terrorist group, not Al-Qaeda this time, but ISIS or ISIL. People seem to be going back
or
and forth.
Islamic State.
Or Islamic State.
Except they're rebranding.
After the media was accused of, again, so-called falling down on the job with the Iraq war. So here we are, recognizing the circumstances are different. I mean, we're not going in with boots on the ground and shock and awe and so forth. But how does the media approach this effort by this president differently than the last effort by the last president?
How should it?
How should it? And then maybe how might it?
It happened, you know, fairly quickly. So
let's start with how should it.
Well, wouldn't it be great if the analysis of what the president was doing was not entirely 100% politically inflected all the time, which is pretty much what's happened ever since he's been elected. You know, you just sometimes it's agonizing for his opponents in the Congress to find a way to argue against something that in a previous session they had completely supported. You know, it's maddening. So it'd be great if we could have some clarity from his critics and his supporters on the Hill so that this doesn't become just another proxy political argument. I think it does great damage to the American public to hear things only pushed through this, you know, the political, I like to call it, Plato extruder, where everything comes out as a partisan issue. You know, some things need to be seen for what they are, good, bad, or otherwise. Now, there is a huge difference between, say, this event or other subsequent events that happened after the war, and I can talk about how that goes, but we can't ignore the initial 9/11 thing, but it was different.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a break. And you can join us, too. The exchange number for you to join our conversation with Brooke Gladstone, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, On the Media co-host Brooke Gladstone is with us, and you can join us too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're looking at the way the news has covered breaking news and Brooke's guide to coverage of breaking news. We're also talking about how the media reported on the last efforts against terrorism and how that might or might not change. We'd love your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange at nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Brooke, before we go to our listeners, so we were talking about, all right, a lot of people say the media did not do a great job covering the Iraq war. You described it as covering it through a bunch of soda straws. How might the media approach this new effort announced by President Obama differently? We were starting with how should it, and then how might it, which could be two different things.
Do you mind if I start a little ways back?
Absolutely.
Because I think we need to start with the coverage of the run-up to the Iraq War, which was where most of the criticism was focused, not so much on the war itself. There was criticism of that as well, and certainly I can go there. But it was the run-up, I think, that got the biggest problem, because there were shifting sets of reasons why we should go in. You know, harboring terrorists, although of all the awful things Saddam Hussein was, he wasn't a huge fan of groups like Al-Qaeda. Nevertheless, there was the claim that there was an association, again, never proved, implied, even charged by the vice president, Dick Cheney, but never proved. Same thing, weapons of mass destruction. We don't want the next attack to be a mushroom cloud, that famous line that Condoleezza Rice said. Again, never found them in Iraq. And then finally, the third rationale was we need a bastion of democracy in the region that can thrive and show the other nations in the region that they were doing. So we had this kind of thing. In the beginning of almost every war that we've ever participated in, there has been some lie that has, you know, everybody knows about the Gulf of Tonkin, an attack that never occurred, that was the reason for escalating our involvement in Vietnam to, you know, a devastating degree. There were in the first attack on Iraq after Saddam invaded Kuwait, there was a completely fabricated presentation before Congress by a woman who said she was a nurse who saw babies being dumped out of bassinets in a hospital.
I remember that.
And that was a Hill and Knowlton complete fabrication. The woman was the daughter of an ambassador, a Kuwaiti ambassador, on and on and on. And the vote to go into Iraq the first time was only a few points. A few votes. It may have been that we wouldn't have gone in the first time.
You're talking about the Gulf War. Kuwait.
The Gulf War, yeah. Yes. Okay, so we have a horrible, unprecedented, I would argue, national trauma, at least a trauma we haven't experienced probably since the Civil War. And this attack on our shores, that is multiplied over and over again by the image of the towers on television coming down, 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 down. So all of that in the background. I will now jump to the series of things that have happened since. You know, let's talk about the Arab Spring. Let's talk about what is our role there. What about our role in Libya? What about our role in Syria? And now, fundamentally, what is our role in Iraq? This information is incredibly complex. Nobody needs me to say that. You don't need a media critic to know that. Everything hinges on everything else, and yet everything is squeezed through these very narrow prisms. Is our role is to save democracy around the world? Is it just to protect our interests? Does our interest involve making the Middle East entirely, remaking it? Is that even possible? And how you answer those questions depends on how you feel about this particular course of action recommended by the president. He at least got a new leader who says he'll be more open to the warring factions in Iraq right now, which means there is something to defend. I mean, prior to that point, there wasn't. The prior leader, Maliki, wasn't worth defending.
So how does the media help the American people sort through all this now, Brooke, because they don't want to be fooled? So how do you help them?
Well, it's not the same as in the run-up to the Gulf War in that we aren't all traumatized anymore. And the press, believe it or not, are people too. I don't excuse them at all. But often when the press has to do politically unpopular work, they have a Congress grousing and they can use the Congress as cover so they're not accused of being biased, which is terror by the press or terror, you know, which the press is terrified of. In the case on the run-up to the Gulf War, Congress was absolutely supine. Or prostrate, I should say, and so offered no cover there. So very little pushback from the press. Now you'll see tons of analysis. And what you need to do is consider the source. Who is doing the criticism? As I said, we're talking about abundance, not scarcity. There isn't a unitary press that's going to lie to you. There are lots of people across the political spectrum who would seek to influence you and will not necessarily give you an honest and fair depiction of what is proposed and what is going on. And we certainly saw that during the run-up to the Affordable Care Act.
So how do you choose, then?
How do you choose
which source you're going to go to, given this abundance? And maybe that abundance, you know, I don't want to say it's good or bad, but it's definitely confusing.
It's a horrible, horrible responsibility that is being placed on all of us. You know, if you ever if you've ever read the label of some food item you were considering buying, then you know that if you did that for every morsel you put in your mouth, it would take a long, long time. If there's somebody you like and you trust, then you have to examine yourself and say, is it just because they agree with me or is it because they know what they're talking about? One media critic, Jack Schaefer, works for Reuters, used to say, if you like a reporter, reverse report the story. Because always nowadays, with links and with a very rudimentary research, you can take their sources, like checking the footnotes in a book to see whether they've been properly quoted, reverse report the story. Is this person accurate? Is this person fairly representing the sources that they use in their piece? And most important, does this person have the expertise to talk about this issue? Have they talked about similar issues in the past? Do they have the sources? And will they name at least some of them? Whenever you see senior administration official, they're almost always not saying anything worth hearing. It's all about access. There's a really weird Stockholm syndrome that goes on, where if you can get someone to talk to, it really doesn't matter what they say or why they say it. So all of those things can be derived. I mean, really not necessarily who the speaker is, although often it's the vice president or the chief of staff. What's important is when something is being said, why do you think it's being said? And can you track that down? You have to do some of your own reporting. Once you find that cadre of people you trust, then you can return to them. They'll be righter than wrong most of the time, though we all make mistakes.
I have another question for you on that, Brooke, but let's go to our listeners. Mm-hmm. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're talking with Brooke Gladstone, co-host of the NPR Weekend Program on the Media. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Jim's in Goffstown. Hi, Jim. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I was listening to an NPR program yesterday or the day before. There was a reporter on there from the New York Times who was embedded in the Iraq War. He mentioned that there were times when he wrote stories while he was embedded that the White House called the New York Times and asked them to change what he had reported because it gave a bad light on things that were going on in the war. He also reported that was with the Bush administration, but he also reported that after we pulled our troops out, that civilian deaths were mounting in Baghdad, and every time he tried to make a report on that, the White House called again and tried to have the report changed. And I'm outraged at that, and I'm curious if this person has ever run into this and how prevalent is this.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling in. Brooke, I'd love your thoughts on that particular question. And also, if you can let us know, it's my understanding this happens in a lot of wars. World War I, for example, I think you could get in huge trouble if you said anything against the war, if you were a British reporter, for example. So I'd love for you to answer Jim's question, what you know about it, but also put it in that historical context. Mm-hmm. If this happened, I don't think it's the first time.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Jim, is he still on the line? Jim?
He is, yeah.
You don't happen to remember who that reporter was, because my guess is that there are certain things that you would have to they might want to ensure that operational, like locations of various troops, on the ground and so forth, they might want lag time on that kind of thing.
But the mission would not be compromised.
But I do not think, and they may have heard from some, press person from the White House, I suppose, saying, we'd prefer you don't do that. But there isn't any way that they could suppress that information. They can't stop that information from being printed. Can you give me a little more on
that? Yeah, and Jim is not with us. I apologize.
That's all right.
Yeah, but even though maybe there's no law saying that they can or can't, I can imagine a scenario where any White House might say to a reporter, look, don't do that.
Yeah, sure, they'd say that.
And we won't let you into our briefings anymore or give you access to top officials.
And let me talk about this unique arrangement of embedding. For most reporters, I mean, I think there was only one who managed to get out of it, Dexter Filkins of the New York Times. But for most reporters, if you are embedded with the troops, you had to stay in your embed. If you left, you lost your position. Another reporter came in. So why would you stay with the troops? Well, first of all, these are young Americans risking their lives. It's a good story. You want to be there. It's a way to see the war. But if you were there, you couldn't leave. In other words, you could see where the bombs took off, but you couldn't see where they landed. The people who saw where they landed were called unilaterals. They were on their own. They had no protection from the American military, so they were very, very vulnerable. The perfect situation is if you had unilaterals on the one side working for, you know, a great paper or news outlet, and embedded reporters with the troops. But
and then you can present those stories side by side.
You can present them side by side. There were great efforts to do that. The great papers did do that. The Washington Post, I remember, did an amazing piece. It was an embedded reporter with troops, saw people being massacred at a checkpoint, you know, shot by the troops. They were able to, maybe massacre is a big word, but the killing of civilians, they were able to report that even when with the troops. So it wasn't a total loss, but it was a very blinkered view.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you for the question. And again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Speaking of unilaterals and reporters who are really on the ground and not protected, we have, as you know, Brooke, here in New Hampshire, James Foley, who was beheaded by ISIS or ISIL or Islamic State, who had strong connections to New Hampshire. He's from Rochester. His parents are here. And then another journalist, Stephen Sutloff, who attended private school here in New Hampshire. I'd love to talk to you a little bit more, because this is such an important story for people here in the Granite State, about how the beheadings of those young men were covered, the whole debate, Brooke, about, you know, whether you show the video. I have seen pictures. I have purposefully not looked at the video because I don't want to witness that. But even just seeing pictures, you know, printed in the newspapers, what have you folks on the media noticed about coverage of these two just terrible events that President Obama, you know, mentioned last night?
Tell me what you've seen. Describe the pictures that you've seen.
The only pictures I have seen, and I've purposely not watched videos of beheadings because I don't, and as I said, I don't want to witness another person's death. But the pictures I've seen in the paper show James Foley. He's in an orange sort of jumpsuit, and it's clear his hands are behind his back. And then there's a scary black hooded guy, and it looks like he's, you know, it looks like the last moments of his life. It's very disturbing.
And Sutloff?
I don't remember the pictures of Sotloff,
I don't,
except pictures of him from an earlier,
you see, that's
happier
just it.
Era.
I don't remember those pictures. Yeah. I also haven't sought them out, but I don't have an image, and I'm wondering whether or not there was more forbearance with Sotloff, and I was just asking for your anecdotal view whether or not that's the case. I could be wrong. I'm just wondering whether we saw less of that with Sotloff, because I'm not seeing, I don't have an image of him in a jumpsuit or anything like that.
Yes.
So there may have been forbearance. I doubt that Islamic State or whatever you want to call it actually, you know, withheld pictures out of delicate sensibilities.
Oh,
so
no,
I'm
talking about
assuming
American
that they,
media printing
that they
those
were
pictures.
Less, I'm assuming that they were less used by the Western press.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of the debate that has emerged. And there is a debate that comes about images all the time, and the press are forced to confront it. And what I particularly loved is lately there's a great consciousness both on the part of the news consumer and on these picture editors or whoever it is out there, including ordinary people who choose to retweet, about what to pick. And I don't know, do I have time now to
yes,
talk
you do.
About?
Yes.
Okay. There was, after the killing of Michael White in Ferguson, there was a picture of him kind of scowling with his fingers in what some called a gang sign and other people called a peace sign. And it looked like he was kind of goofing. It was really a serious scowl, you know, that kind of thing. But it was used a lot by the media. And as a result, many of the people in Ferguson and around the country, young people, had the hashtag, if they gunned me down. And the question was, if they gunned me down, what picture would they choose? Would they choose that one?
Well, that's really creepy.
Or would they choose the picture of, you know, would they choose one of them looking scary in front of a cell phone? Or would they choose a picture of the guy maybe in his Marine dress uniform? Because people have a million ways that they present themselves. And the way that we use social media, you know, gives you an opportunity to take on whatever image you feel like having.
And your high school yearbook photo where you look lovely and you have a tie on or whatever.
Or you could be doing the drunk thing at the frat party. I mean, the thing is that we contain multitudes, right, as Whitman said. Okay, so if they gunned me down was a rebuke to the press, be careful what picture you choose to show because it's a tiny, tiny slice. Now, ISIS or the Islamic State understands this very well. They have an unprecedentedly well-thought-out media strategy, and they have the tools. They have the video. They understand how to avoid a lot of the blocks that Twitter or that governments use to keep them down. So they came out with the video of James Foley. It appeared on various sites. Twitter played whack-a-mole to try and stop the sites. They kept sources kept popping up again. And then I'll tell you what happened because it was actually really interesting and gives us a huge lesson.
All right. Well, more after a short break. And if you're on the line, we'll be right back with you. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, Brooke Gladstone is here, longtime media observer and reporter, co-host of the award-winning NPR program On the Media. She's also the author of the book The Influencing Machine, a media manifesto in graphic novel form. You can join us with your questions and comments about how the media is approaching some of these very difficult stories, whether it's the shooting of an unarmed teenager or the recent announcement of airstrikes against ISIS, or the presentation of the beheading of American journalists. Very tough stuff. And we're wading through with Brooke Gladstone about how the media approaches all this. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Brooke, just before the break, we were talking about the story of Michael Brown. This is the teenager in Ferguson who was shot by police. And then the picture that was sort of put up there of him where he's sort of scowling and making a ghetto pose.
Right.
And you were saying this started a whole Twitter thing about by young people about, okay, if I was gunned down, what picture would they use?
Hashtag if they gunned me down. And Michael Brown was, if you saw a variety of pictures, the ones posted by the family, he looks like a big sweetie. And then you see him looking, I mean, and who knows? I didn't know him. All I know is that one tiny slice of that person being the, a picture, and the beautiful thing is that when that picture of him scowling and doing whatever the double peace sign or the gang sign, whatever you want to call it, came out, there was an instant reaction, a consciousness of the messages sent either consciously or unconsciously by some photo editor, and what it means and how it colors the entire story. And this is what brings me to James Foley, because ISIS, Islamic State, ISIL, whatever, knows exactly what it's doing.
Yeah, you said they were very savvy. Yeah,
very savvy. And what happened was when the links to the video appeared on Twitter, within a very short period of time, the journalism community was out there tweeting to themselves. And one reporter, a woman whose name I didn't recognize, this was a global discussion, she said, I know this sounds crazy, but let's not tweet it. Let's not retweet it. Let's start the hashtag, and now I'm not remembering the name of the hashtag, but it was like, stop ISIS image making or something along those lines, but I can't remember. And within an hour, Within an hour, Laura, from D.C. to Paris, this was trending. The reporters stopped retweeting it. Others stopped retweeting it. And instead, in the same hashtag argument, conversation, movement, started tweeting and retweeting other pictures of James Foley. James Foley at work. James Foley happily engaged. James, you know, Foley smiling, doing something. In other words, this is how you will remember him. This is how we remember him. We are not going to let some other group create a narrative about our colleague that isn't true and is purely manipulative and is just another tool in their media toolkit. We will stop it. And this is the interesting thing. As I spoke to Scott Shane, who's been covering, a reporter who's been covering the strategy of Islamic State for a while, the media strategy, and he said that governments have been trying to tamp it down, and they have not been able to because they're always popping up like whack-a-mole.
Right.
There's no real technical solution. The only solution is to choose as a news consumer and as a participant in the Twitter sphere, if you'll forgive the cliche, to not participate in that. And if reporters can do that, then anybody can do it. It takes no skill at all. It takes a simple choice. With every tweet, you've voted. If you retweet a picture of James Foley, then you're saying it's okay for us to be spreading this picture around. And let me make one more distinction, because the debate has to do over whether they should have done it, whether they should have haven't done it. I think it's been a little bizarrely phrased, because the fact is, no journalist said, we will not report on Islamic State anymore. We will not give them the satisfaction of you know, being reported on or getting ink. What they said was, we won't tweet this picture. Not that we won't tell the story of the beheading, but we won't accept the narrative and the framing that is being supplied by Islamic State. It doesn't mean a news blackout. It means a declining, refusing, rejecting the narrative frame of the story. It seems like a fine distinction, but it means everything.
You know, at our meeting, back on the exchange, we had a discussion about this, and someone said, you know, hey, you know, the pictures are graphic and they're horrible and they're disturbing. On the other hand, they help us understand how terrible this group is and the terrible lengths that they're willing to go. This probably was the same discussion book that they had many years ago when, you know, older listeners will remember the picture of the naked, screaming little girl running down the road in Vietnam, right? I mean, people said, how can you show that? On the other hand, it sort of showed people the horror of what was happening to children in Vietnam. So I just wonder what your thoughts are about that.
I have thoughts about that. I think that we need to consider the provenance. I mean, the little girl with napalm running down the street in Vietnam was taken by a reporter, a photojournalist. It wasn't taken by the North Viet Cong and ordered, or, you know. I really do think that that's important. Another thing is, if you look at that war, I don't think – do you know how many Vietnamese were killed in that war? Have you even a vague idea? Most people don't, Laura. We know how many Americans were killed, right? How many? Do you know? 50,000. Most people think that, you know, we lost that war. And we did. But Vietnam is not a huge country. At least 2 million people were killed. The crucial thing is that they were anonymous hordes, you know? Even when the reporters were there doing television, they were still anonymous hordes. They needed to be humanized. We are seeing a lot of deaths in all over the Middle East, but not the kind of number that was going on in Vietnam. That was a part of the story that had to be told, and it had to be told graphically. Am I arguing against graphic imagery? It's a good question. I am not. It's powerful, and it's important, but it has to be real, and it has to be considered, and it has to be discussed. It can't just be swallowed by the, you know, by the corporate communications people over an Islamic State.
Which seems crazy that they've got a whole communication strategy, but as you said, and as we've seen, Brooke, they're very sophisticated. Let's go back to our listeners. Peter's in New London. Hi, Peter. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for this show, on especially on the sad day of 9/11. I just wanted to thank Brooke for the work that she does. I enjoy her shows on the media, etc. And, you know, I did hear you mention earlier about the Gulf of Tonkin and, you know, the kind of the lies that went in leading up to the Iraq War and stuff. And maybe you feel like the media dropped the ball on that. And in terms of the 9/11 events 13 years ago, do you think that there are areas that were kind of off limits, or do you think that it was well covered? What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks a lot for the call, Peter.
It's really a wonderful question because, you know, when there is breaking news, as we discussed at the beginning of the hour, there are always mistakes. But weirdly, if you poll the public, and the public always says, you know, we want the media to be accurate. But when you ask them about when they like the media and when they don't, it's when the media reflect their emotions and their priorities. And it seems that the accuracy takes a back seat. There was some enormously inaccurate reporting after Katrina, but the media really spiked in the polls because you had, you know, Anderson Cooper and all these other people being angry and outraged at the authorities. And after 9/11, you had on television a sense of the confusion and the anguish that the whole nation felt coming through, even though the information was frequently wrong. In the run-up to the war, post 9/11, we were still dealing, as I said, with the trauma. And there was just, I think there was pulling of punches. I think, you know, it's funny. I once met with a gaggle of Chinese journalists who said, you know, the American media is really afraid of the government. You know, that's why Bill Maher lost his show and you know, other people. And I said, no, actually, the American media is not afraid of the government. They're afraid of their audiences and advertisers. And they're not manipulating us so much as they are pandering to us and tell us to some degree what we want to hear that isn't so complicated. Uncomfortable truths are just not popular, and they generate a lot of anguish and sometimes lose advertisers. And I don't think it's as venal as I make it sound, but there's this unconscious sense of risk. And I think that when the emotions are acute, as they were post 9/11, there were more pulling of punches.
Thanks a lot for that call. And a couple tweets and emails that have come in, Brooke. Let's try and squeeze them in as we close out the show. Here's Jeff, who says he loves your show. He says, I'd like to hear Brooke's thoughts about the increasing polarization of the media. And how about the large TV and radio program that is clearly biased either to the left or right is skewing the way we view events? Jeff says, it's my opinion that this sort of, quote, entertainment masquerading as news is doing a great disservice to the public's right to accurate information. Jeff's got another question, but let's deal with that.
I'll answer that. I'll try to answer that in a minute, even though it's like a half hour or another hour.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'll just say very quickly that very few people actually watch cable compared to how many people watch networks. And, of course, the growing number of people go online, and that increases all the time. It is doing those programs frequently are doing a great disservice in that they feed a lot of crap into the environment. On the other hand, you don't have to watch it. You don't have to listen to it. You don't have to eat it. You can go out there and find good stuff. It is there. I keep returning to that main point. Polarization? Well, there have been some recent studies that suggest that actually the public is pretty much as polarized as it ever was. The difference is that the people who are on the extremes are not more numerous, but they are much more powerful because they can use these megaphones to influence the message. You know, if you aren't going to retweet a picture of James Foley, then don't sit there and have your blood pressure rise. I mean, if these people could just talk to each other, we'd all be a lot better off, because the fact is most of the country really is moderate, and the Congress would be more moderate, too, if it weren't for gerrymandering and political primaries.
And there's been a lot of discussion. We've talked about that on this show, about how districts are drawn and so forth, and you get extremes from the right and the left. We won't go there now. We talked about that with Mara Liasson a couple months ago.
More qualified.
Here's a tweet from Kathleen, who says she'd love to hear Brooke's thoughts on news outlets posting the Ray Rice video. Now, most people know what this is, but just give us a little on that. That's the Baltimore football player.
The guy in the elevator.
Beat up his fiancée and knocked her unconscious, and it's horrible.
All right.
And,
okay.
And there's been a lot of conversation about
this. Yes, there has. And actually, that came up last night as well when I was talking at UNH. All right. Here's the thing, is that you didn't need news outlets to post that video. I mean, the fact is, who did it? TMZ, right? Not exactly a super news. It's not the first source of news. It's not where we go. On the other hand, I think, based on not a close study of this case, I have to say this happened when I was in transit, is that the NFL may have had the opportunity to cover this thing up if it hadn't come out there. It's grand guignol. It's pretty terrible. It's gross. Again, you don't have to watch it. I'm kind of glad it's out there.
Now, this is interesting, and you said this a couple times just in the last couple minutes, Brooke, and it's an interesting point. We talked earlier in the hour about how there's so much out there, and now we're talking about what's the responsibility of various outlets to put this out there and or retweet it or whatever. Now you're saying, look, individual news consumer, it may be out there. That doesn't mean you have to eat it. You know, you can go to a buffet, but you don't have to eat everything that's presented to you.
And again, consider the provenance. We were arguing about whether or not we accept what the Islamic State gives us. Do you want to be horrified at a football player beating the crap out of someone? Go ahead. I'm kind of glad it's out there because it's evidence in a legal case. I mean, I wouldn't have to see it, but I'm glad it's there for the jury.
Yeah, it's tricky, though. You know, I mean, I might choose not to look at that or some of the other things from ISIL. But, you know, I've got a teenager and a preteen, and, you know, teenagers don't make the best decisions. I do worry about my kids being exposed to some of this stuff and just going, yeah, that looks interesting. Let's look at it.
And what happens if they do?
Well, I don't know if I would want my children to watch a beheading. That's pretty horrible.
Right. I agree. Although, if they – do you keep them away from, like, R-rated movies and things like that?
I try.
Okay. You got a tough road to hoe there,
yeah.
Laura.
Yeah.
You can explain to them why, but people will be curious. Well, they'll put their fingers on the stove, especially young people. I don't know. I mean, everything is so unreal when seen through the prism of a screen. You almost have to try to remind yourself that it's real when you look at it.
You know, you spoke at UNH last night to some journalism students, and we were sort of joking this morning that we're glad there still are journalism students. You know, we hear about the consolidation and all the problems in the media. What do you say to young people, aspiring journalists who might have come up to you last night at UNH saying, Brooke, I want to be a reporter? What do you tell them when many older reporters, not me, by the way, I'm more optimistic, are feeling kind of beaten down by what's been happening in the traditional news industry?
Yeah. I mean, the business model has fallen apart. You know, they have to recreate it. There is going to be a world in which people will pay for the information that they want. The internet has given us an opportunity for too long to have things for free. But fundamentally, I feel that if you want to get paid as a journalist in this atmosphere, first of all, you need to know how to tell a story well. You need to have an authentic voice, and you need to be an expert on something that people want to know. It also helps to understand the tools of your trade, the digital tools of your trade. So you can use audio and video and even code a little bit, or at least be able to track a tweet or triangulate a tweet with other tweets to know where it came from. These kinds of tools help, But fundamentally, you need a story, you need a voice, and you need an area of expertise that people want.
Okay. Brooke, excuse me. It's great to see you.
Laura,
thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
I really had a great time.
That's Brooke Gladstone, again, co-host of On the Media. This is The Exchange on NHPR.